This Is the Europeans, hosted by me, Katie Lee, your resident, very tired, very stressed out Parisian journalist. And this week, standing in for Dominic, it's our producer in Warsaw. Hello, Wojciech Oleksiak.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm fine. It's been good. Just one thing that really bothers everybody, and let me just be the most British person in the room for a second, is that the weather in Poland has been absolutely tropical in the past weeks.
Yeah, you've had like 40 degrees in Warsaw, right? Which is not, sorry to bring stereotypes into it, it's not what people think of Warsaw.
No, I don't think. And then, you know, we go from extreme heat to monsoon rains and back. And like, you know, I'm okay with it. Although one of these rains completely ruined my son's birthday garden party.
No.
But we moved it inside and it was even more hectic and they loved it. But then, you know, I've got this grandma who's 95 years old and she's really struggling to bear with it. Mm. Like, you know, she never had to endure anything like that.
Oh, poor thing.
So, yeah. But anyway, I guess the political climate is even hotter in Paris.
Oh, nice segue.
How are you coping?
Oh, you know, I'm fine. Unless you've been living under a rock, listeners, you'll probably know by now that we've had some pretty disturbing elections over here. However, I'm going to hold all of my very wise, insightful commentary till next week, because one of the joys of the French elections is that there are two rounds. And what's going to happen this coming Sunday, round two, is still incredibly difficult to predict. So we're going to check in after that second and final round in next week's podcast, when we're going to be interviewing me, apparently.
Can't wait.
Me neither.
Okay, so what are we talking about this week?
This week, we do have some non-French political stories that we're going to delve into in a second. But we're also going to be taking refuge from the political world in a great interview about cinema. What can films do to bring us together on this divided continent? And how does the way that films get funded across Europe affect the kind of films that actually get made here? We're going to discuss those things and more with not one but two great guests from the European film world. They are Anna Schulke and Tamara Konarich.
Great, can't wait.
But first. Who's had a good week, Wojciech?
So I'm giving a double good week to Estonia's current Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas.
A double good week? Why is Kaja Kallas getting a double good week?
Well, let's be honest, I've been in love with Kaja Kallas for a long time, but that's not the actual reason.
Okay.
First of all, the leaders of the current Council of the European Union have appointed her the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy.
Is that good? What do all of those words mean?
Well, it's a mouthful, but also it is a super prestigious job. I would say it's as close to being the EU's foreign affairs minister as it gets in the EU.
Okay, nice job.
Yeah, bravo. It's a massive accomplishment, and I really think it's a well-deserved one. For the record, other notable appointments include the most polarizing, boring person on earth, Ursula von der Leyen, staying as president of the European Commission, and Portugal's former prime minister, António Costa, replacing Charles Michel as president of the European Council.
So these are all of the biggest jobs in the EU that have just been dished out to different powerful European politicians as a result of the European elections that we've just had, right?
Yeah. It's quite a lineup. It feels like an all-star game, but I think it's good. So the reason for Kaja Kallas to have a double good week is that eventually she'll have to resign from her current role as Estonia's prime minister, which seems to be a relief for both her and many Estonians.
Oh, I thought she was quite popular. Was she actually not very well loved as a prime minister then?
Well, yes and no. But, you know, I guess there are these politicians who are incredibly popular internationally, but receive more nuanced opinions at home.
Mm-hmm.
Take my fellow countryman Donald Tusk. Abroad, he's seen as Europe's providential father. But in Poland, even some of his supporters can be lukewarm. And people voting left are strongly critical.
Mm.
Is there a similar person in France like this?
Ooh, I guess you could say Emmanuel Macron is kind of that sort of politician, and that on the international stage, he's seen as like a quite prominent leader in Europe and someone who is smart and articulate, which he is. But he is also, as you might have noticed, not loved around here in domestic politics. But what's the issue with Kaja Kallas in domestic politics? I think there was a scandal that you mentioned a while back when we were chatting, something to do with her husband.
Oh, yeah, that was nasty. But yeah, I'll get to that in a second. But first, maybe let's just focus on the bright side of Kaja Kallas.
Because you love her.
Yeah, That's true. So basically, she's been a darling of European politics, especially since 2022, when she became a leading advocate for supporting Ukraine in their efforts to fend off Vladimir Putin's troops. Something really interesting I found about her is that as early as December 2021, so that was 3 months before the actual full-scale invasion, her government decided to send weapons to Kyiv. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty controversial decision at the time. But in an interview from that period, she said something I really liked, so I'm gonna quote it. So she said, quote, "Our neighbor's problems today are our problems tomorrow. So if your neighbor's house is in flames, it's better to put out the fire there than to wait until the fire reaches your house," end quote.
Yeah, difficult to argue with that.
Right? But throughout the war, she's consistently reminded those not feeling directly the Russian threat that this is their war too. And I found a very interesting fact is that by mid-April 2022, so 2 months into the war, Germany had transferred 0.01% of its GDP to Ukraine. The US and UK were around 0.05%. Poland was just under 0.2%, so much more. And then Estonia's figure was 0.8%.
Wow.
Yeah. So she really put her money where her mouth was. And some of her speeches during that time were, at the very least, momentous.
When my father was leading the Estonian negotiations to join NATO, he was often asked, "Why do you need this? Russia does not pose a threat anymore." Well, we knew our neighbor then, and we also know our neighbor now. I can only be grateful to the decision to join the Defense Alliance, but being part of the alliance also comes with the obligations. The 2% of the GDP defense spending target must become an absolute minimum requirement.
Okay, so you keep lavishing praise on Kaja Kallas, but you've mentioned that her own voters are maybe not so keen.
Yeah, it's because internally, her term has been described as turbulent and full of conflicts. She faced criticism for strict COVID-19 restrictions and vaccination mandates. And then, you know, like many leaders, she's also been blamed for not curbing inflation enough and for the housing crisis in Estonia, which has been exceptionally bad even compared to other countries in the EU. Mm. The first low point in her career was when her first cabinet fell due to a massive conflict with coalition partners. And that was so bad that everybody thought that this was the end of her career as prime minister. But she formed another cabinet. She won subsequent elections, formed her third cabinet, already starting to be called the Estonian Iron Lady at the time. But then last year, the scandal broke out.
The scandal, the husband scandal.
Yeah, that was huge. Mm-hmm. So as we've established, Kallas' strong stance against Russia defines her public image. But in 2023, a year into the war, Estonian public broadcaster ERR exposed that Stark Logistics, a company where her husband Arvo Halik was a minority shareholder and chief financial officer, was still doing business in Russia despite the sanctions Kallas had vocally supported.
Oh no, that is a really bad look.
Right, it is. And initially, it looked really, really bad, and for quite some time, I have to say. So Kallas denied knowing about her husband's business activities, but circumstantial evidence suggested otherwise.
Huh. What kind of evidence?
So, for instance, she lent one of his other businesses 350,000 euro, which reportedly was around 35-50% of her savings at the time.
That's very nice of her. I'm not sure I'd lend my husband 350,000 euros without asking what it was for.
Well, I think I wouldn't lend my wife 50% of my savings even if I knew what it was for. Anyway, after weeks of detailed explanations, public criticism from even Estonia's president Alar Karis, who claimed she's tarnishing Estonia's credibility internationally, and after numerous opposition calls for her resignation, she somehow prevailed.
How did she manage that?
So she and her husband, they managed to explain that the company was only providing logistics for another Estonian company that was wrapping up operations in Russia. Mm. And the trucks were driven by non-Russian drivers, taxes were all paid in Estonia. They even said that they refueled in Estonia. So all in all, it seemed more like her husband's lack of due diligence than deliberate unethical behavior. Mm. But still, It looked like the end of her political career for a moment.
But clearly not. I guess she's not called the Estonian Iron Lady for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I found another Kallas nickname while preparing for this. Do you know what it is?
I don't know, no.
The Hummer of Moscow.
Oh, that's quite a badass nickname. I'd love to be called the Hammer of somewhere.
The Hammer of Paris, or?
The Hammer of Paris. So what can we actually expect from her if she's going to be basically the foreign minister of the EU?
So yeah, definitely a very strong pro-Ukrainian and anti-Russian stance is guaranteed. Some critics say she's too involved in the Putin versus West conflict and might not focus enough on our relationships with North African countries, for example. However, she has vowed to be a representative of all states and all of their causes. Another concern is that she's very strong-willed and might not be patient enough to, you know, painstakingly build compromises among the 27 member states. And her predecessor, Josep Borrell, was actually very good at this, so she has some big shoes to fill.
But you think it's going to be a relief for her to maybe move out of domestic politics. Who is actually stepping in for her and becoming the new prime minister in Estonia?
So this time it's a man. It's Kristen Michal, who's currently the minister of climate and a longtime politician. He's been actually waiting for this top job for many years now. And he's expected to focus more on internal affairs and be less spontaneous, but more conciliatory, maybe. He's also a strong organizer, something Kaja Kallas wasn't especially praised for. And interestingly, he was involved in a massive scandal in 2012 involving money laundering accusations by a member of his own party. That scandal, I took like 30 minutes to go into that. It's super shady. But eventually, we have to admit the case was dropped. He was never charged with anything. And yeah, he's going to succeed Kaja Kallas as next Estonia's prime minister. We'll see how he measures up as a successor to a divisive political star. And we, Europeans, will now be represented by the Iron Lady, the Hammer of Moscow, the one and only Kaja Kallas.
I'm really interested to see what she does with this job.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so who has had a bad week?
Well, I'm sorry to say it's been a pretty bad week for the European political mainstream, France being, of course, a very obvious example of this. But like I said, I'm saving France for next week. So I'm going to zoom out a bit and talk about something else that's been going on more widely in European politics this week. And that is the creation of a new alliance of European far-right and populist parties. It's called Patriots for Europe.
Just what we needed.
Just what we needed. So far, the things listed that Patriots for Europe don't like are 1, migration, and 2, the Brussels elite. And this new alliance was set up this week by none other than Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. I'm very sorry for giving that man yet more airtime. But I don't know, I always find this idea of international alliances of the far right to be quite interesting, because these are organizations that are literally built on the idea of putting their own nation first. So intrinsically, you'd think that an international union of them might be doomed to fail. So it's kind of an interesting story. I thought it was worth digging into this week.
Yeah, so let me just stress that again. This alliance is exactly what we needed these days. But just let me clarify, it's an alliance of European populist and far-right parties. And obviously, you mean it's going to exist in the European Parliament, right?
Well, that's their plan. As most of you will know, we had elections for the European Parliament nearly a month ago now. Hundreds of millions of people voting in the second biggest elections on this planet. No big deal. And even though if you voted in those elections, you will have voted for a national party. On a European level, those national parties all club together to form kind of mega parties. So all of the centre-left parties form a big grouping, all the centre-right ones, all the green ones, etc. And they generally try to vote and support bits of legislation as a bloc. And one of the interesting things that we talked about in the two episodes that we made around these elections is that there's all of this kind of flux and reconfiguration going on in the European far right at the moment. One of the things that happened just before the elections is that Marine Le Pen decided that Germany's far right AfD were too toxic to be allowed in her far right European Parliament grouping, which is called the Identity and Democracy Group. So they got kicked out. We've now had the elections, and far-right and populist parties broadly did pretty well, although it varied from country to country. The upshot of that is that there are a lot of far-right new members of the European Parliament that aren't currently attached to one of these party groupings. But it's really in their interest to see if they can club together in some way.
I really wonder where is the red line of you are too toxic for us and you are not. Yeah. But anyway, why is it in their interest? Why is it better to be a part of political grouping in the European Parliament?
Mostly because you can earn a bunch of cash by being in a group. Ka-ching! There's actually a really nice pot of money from the EU budget that gets handed out to these parties. This year it's worth 67.5 million euros. So that's extra money that you can spend on hiring staff, generally keeping your political operation running. You also get more influence if you're part of a group. Things like more speaking time in parliament, more of a say over things like who gets chosen to chair what committee, which sounds really boring, but it can actually be quite consequential for the way that our laws shape up.
Power and money.
Power and money. Always the answer. But forming one of these groups is not that easy. You need to gather at least 23 members of parliament for your group, and they need to represent at least 7 different EU countries.
So who's actually already on board with this great new alliance of Orbán's?
We've got 4 parties already from 4 different countries. So there's Orbán's own hard-right party, Fidesz. You also have Austria's far-right Freedom Party. You have the Czech party, ANO, which is the party of another populist leader that we've talked about a fair amount in the past, Andrej Babiš.
Them too.
And as of Monday, the far-right party in Portugal, Chega, they've also joined.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. So they've got 4 parties from 4 countries involved already. They need 3 more. And apart from Chega, who are a pretty new party, they weren't in the European Parliament last time around, these are all parties that have left an existing group. So they're really symptomatic of all of this kind of chop and change that has been going on in how the European far right organises itself. Now, in terms of who else might be tempted to come on board to fill that criteria of having 7 parties from 7 countries, at the time of recording, there are rumours that Marine Le Pen's party, the Rassemblement National, they are thinking about joining. Also from Italy, the Lega party of Matteo Salvini. And excitingly for you, my Polish friend, Law and Justice, the former ruling party of Poland. They are reportedly considering the idea of joining this new alliance.
What a bunch. Oh my God.
It's nice to hang out with your friends. There is a deadline at play here. Thursday, the day that this podcast comes out, is when the party groupings need to be formed if they want to benefit from some of the cushy jobs that are being handed out within the parliament at the moment. But Politico has been reporting that there's been at least one request for an extension to that deadline until after the French elections are done, which is kind of interesting. It suggests that maybe Le Pen is thinking indeed about moving.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're on a tight deadline to get some more countries to join. But what would it mean politically if these guys all got together and formed another quote-unquote all-star group?
I guess it kind of depends just how organized they are and how big they can make themselves. I really feel like this has become the question of European politics of the moment. Like, just how prepared are political forces that have a lot of stuff in common, but some differences? How willing are they to come together to get stuff done? You know, sitting here in France, that really feels like the political question of the time that we're living in right now, in terms of how prepared are the left and centre to overcome the differences and join forces to block the far right? And this is the same kind of question, but for the far right across Europe. At the moment, we have these kind of 2 rival far-right or hard-right groupings in the European Parliament. Could they form a united front potentially? It would certainly benefit them. If you look at Giorgia Meloni at the moment, the far-right Italian Prime Minister, she's really pissed off this week because she wanted one of those top EU jobs that you just talked about to go to someone from her political family. It didn't happen. But maybe if the far right had had just one far right mega block rather than 2 smaller ones, they might have had a better shot. Now, is that going to happen now? I doubt it. It looks more likely that this new alliance is just going to be another small rival to the 2 existing groupings, one of which is the Identity and Democracy grouping, which I mentioned a minute ago. The other of which is the one that Meloni belongs to, which is called the European Conservatives and Reformists. We might see the ID group of Le Pen merging into the new group, but we'd still have 2 groups rather than 1 big one. And the thing that makes me suspect that we're not going to see the formation of like a mega united far-right bloc is that there are still some really big policy differences between different far-right parties in Europe, notably how they feel about Russia. Now, Orbán is widely considered to be Vladimir Putin's biggest fanboy within the EU.
Oh, yeah.
And those Austrian and Czech parties that are involved in the Patriots of Europe, they're also considered very Putin-friendly. The Portuguese party, Chega, is interestingly much less pro-Russian than those other three. But it's come on board anyway, maybe because they're interested in the cash and influence that being part of this group could bring. But ultimately, it's hard to see Giorgia Meloni agreeing to join forces with Orbán and create like a single united far-right grouping in the European Parliament, because they really, really don't see eye to eye on Ukraine and Russia. Which maybe should give a little hope to all of us who would frankly rather that the far right stays divided across Europe.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of Russia and Orbán, Hungary just took over the presidency of the EU for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
So do you think we're going to see things going into more Putin-friendly direction for the next half a year?
I don't think Orbán's going to turn the EU into the friend of Russia that he would maybe like it to be. You don't actually have that much control over the direction of the EU as its president for 6 months. And also Hungary is starting its presidency at a time when the new leadership, all of those people in the top jobs, that isn't properly in place yet. So there isn't actually a huge amount going on right now. However, it can't be denied that ever since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in 2022, Viktor Orbán has done almost everything possible to obstruct help to Ukraine, along with chipping away at democracy at home. Things like turning the media into propaganda, encouraging hatred of gay people, basically behaving more and more like an autocrat. Generally, it's quite surreal to have a country whose leader spends a lot of his time demonizing the EU to be running the show for the next 6 months. Although it's also kind of a reflection of the times. You know, there are now about a quarter of the members of the new European Parliament who are from Eurosceptic parties that don't actually believe in the European project. Now, if you talk to Hungarian diplomats in Brussels, they'll tell you that Hungary is planning to run a quote-unquote normal EU presidency and not rock the boat too much. And that might have something to do with the fact that something like 19 billion euros in EU funding to Hungary remains frozen because of the anti-democratic behavior of Orbán's government. So there is an incentive to be kind of relatively well-behaved, I guess. Mm. On the other hand, I guess you saw what Hungary's slogan for this presidency is.
Oh, come on. I swear I had to check my calendar if it's not April's Fool. Like, it's just that bad.
Can you tell our listeners what it is in case they don't know already?
So it's, yeah, I'm struggling to say this with a straight face. It's Make Europe Great Again.
Make Europe Great Again.
Yeah, and it's called MEGA.
Love it. I mean, it really couldn't be less subtle in terms of where it got its inspiration from, and it couldn't be less imaginative either. There was a funny tweet from a former guest of this show, Szabolcs Panyi, the Hungarian journalist. He said, "It has been rumored for months that Orbán would copy-paste Trump's slogan for the Hungarian EU presidency. However, it sounded so lame and ridiculous that we refrained from reporting it. We were wrong."
Yeah, exactly.
In Brighton news, I actually quite like the logo that the Hungarians have picked for this presidency. Have you seen that?
Was there something with a Rubik's Cube or...?
Yeah, it's a Rubik's Cube. I didn't even know that the Rubik's Cube was a Hungarian invention, did you?
Oh yeah, I was trying to report on that one day, like many years ago, but then the Rubik's family was not interested.
Oh,
they
yeah.
said they've got enough coverage, so yeah.
But if you didn't know, the Rubik's Cube was invented by the Hungarian designer Ernő Rubik in the 1970s. Apparently, as a logo for the Hungarian presidency, it is supposed to be a symbol of both Hungarian inventiveness and European unity. I mean, to me, it seems more like a reminder that European democracy can sometimes seem like a totally unsolvable puzzle. But what do I know? The only reason that Wojciech and I are sitting here today at opposite ends of the internet phone between Paris and Warsaw is that some amazing people pay a little bit of money every month so that we can keep making this weird show that tries to keep people informed about Europe without boring them to death while doing it. So a huge thank you to the extremely generous people who do that so that this podcast can remain in existence and free for people who can't afford to support us. Now, Wojciech, you're not actually here on the show in front of the mic very often. But when you are here, I know that you take disproportionate pleasure in reading out the names of our supporters. So would you like to do the honours?
Yes, I would love. By the way, how do you define disproportionate? I think it's just absolutely, you know, right and proportionate.
You know, whatever gets you going in the morning.
Okay. Anyway, this week, our massive thanks go to Natalie, Andrew, Martin, Karen, Stephen, and to Niels and Abhijit for increasing their donations, which is super kind. Thank you all so much.
Thank you all. You too can do something really nice that helps to bring this continent together every week by signing up to send a little bit of cash our way. All amounts, big and small, are extremely welcome, and it takes literally 2 minutes to do it via our Patreon page. You can find it at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. And there's a link right there on the screen. I'm really glad that you're here this week, Wojciech, as a fellow parent, because you're going to be really impressed with me. Guess what I did this week?
No idea.
I watched a film, like an entire film.
Wow. That's something.
Thank you. I'm very proud of myself. The film was Anatomy of a Fall, which I think Dominic recommended on this show a few months ago. If you haven't seen it, you should. I loved it. It is a French film starring the German actress Sandra Hüller. And I was really struck while watching this film with just how European it felt, but I couldn't articulate why this film felt very European. I think it had a lot to do with the look and feel of it, and also the fact that this film clearly didn't have enough of a budget to have like exploding cars in it, but it was still excellent despite not having exploding cars in it. Also, the storytelling was kind of ambiguous and non-obvious in a way that felt distinctly un-Hollywood-ish. Anyway, I have been thinking a lot about this question recently of why European films are the way they are, because I'm really happy to say that we have teamed up with the lovely people behind Kids Regio for this episode. Kids Regio are a non-profit based in Germany who represent the children's film industry across Europe. They try to make sure that kids across Europe have decent, interesting things to watch, and also that the makers of children's films get access to the resources that they need.
Interesting. I'm watching more kids' films than other films, so I'm really hooked.
Well, later in the year, we're actually going to be bringing you a second conversation with them based on some very interesting research that they've commissioned about what young people are watching across Europe. This week, though, we wanted to look a little bit more generally at the European film industry for kids and grown-ups alike. How does money shape the films that end up getting made in Europe? What can and should the film industry be doing for this continent? I was desperate for a break from politics this week, so I was delighted to be joined for a conversation about these questions and more with Anna Schulke, project manager at Kids Regio, and one of the film experts who joined Anna at Kids Regio's big gathering of European film people last week, Tamara Kodaric, who studies the intersection between politics, film, and memory at Dublin City University. Tamara, Anna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So happy to be here. Quite excited.
So my first question is, how does the size of the European film industry compare to other major film industries around the world, like the US in Hollywood or Bollywood in India?
Okay, last year, if you think about Barbie, which was one of the most seen films also in Europe, I think actually the most seen film in 2023, can you kind of estimate what the budget of Barbie would be?
You're asking me, you're setting me homework. Oh, yeah. I don't know, like $150 million.
Very, very good. Actually, $145 million. Dollars. So the most successful film in Europe last year had a budget around $135 million. And it was produced by a studio that had an overall budget of $1.2 billion. This comes from a really, really large industry. Now, when we're talking about European cinema, we're talking about something significantly smaller. How much do you think was the budget for what was the best European film in 2023, which is Anatomy of a Fall?
Great film. I actually watched it last weekend. What was the budget?
Yeah.
It didn't feel like Barbie in terms of its production values, I would say. I'm going to say that film probably had a budget of 12 million euros.
Barely a half, around 6 million euros.
Wow,
so
okay.
I think this gives you an indication of kind of the sizes of industries that we are talking about. On the one hand, you have this very big American budget. On the other hand, you have quite different systems of funding and quite different budgets. But there's also another way, I think, of thinking about this. One is how many films are produced. And in this sense, European cinema is not that small. In 2023, it produced 2,347 feature-length films, which is both fiction and documentary, which actually is more than the US, a little bit smaller than India. I think India is the largest, around 2,500 films produced. And then you could also ask, okay, how many people see these films? And in this case, European cinema doesn't compare that favorably to the US because 20 most seen films in 2023 in European cinemas were actually American films.
Why is that? And why is it so much less common for Americans to flock to a cinema in big numbers to watch a European film?
When you look at the concrete circumstances of our film industries, it's really that the US market is clearly completely market-driven and the European film industry is much more also subsidized and there's much more this cultural value behind film. So really in Europe, we distinguish between the cultural and the economic good. In the US, it's much more only the economic value of things. So if you have blockbusters from the US, the marketing budgets, the distribution sales budgets, they're huge. I mean, if you go to your local cinema, what are the posters that you see? What are the big things that hang off the walls outside at the building? What are the trailers that you see before you watch the movie that you wanted to watch when you go to the cinema in the evening? So really the way they can position the films that come out of their American film industry, that is a completely different story to what we have available for European cinema.
You've both touched on this a little bit already, the fact that European films have more public funding put into them. How does that shape the kind of films that actually get made here in terms of the kind of stories that get told?
That brings with itself the idea that film is a cultural good. We recognize it as a cultural good, which is on the one hand great because it allows you to make films that are on various different topics, very often related to topics that are seen as kind of culturally favorable, for example, political issues. But it also allows filmmakers to make the kinds of films that are really driven by ideas rather than driven by the necessity to sell the film to a large audience, which makes for a lot more highbrow films, artistic films, even films that experiment with formats in some ways. But on the other hand, it does mean that there is sometimes a little bit of a shortage of emphasis on thinking about audience. So you have a lot of culturally valuable films, which is also one of the kind of target goals of all the European national funds and funds at different levels to produce films that have a cultural, sociopolitical value and going away from kind of the idea that you have to market yourself. So when you think about European film, very often you would think about something that has premiered at a good festival or something that has kind of a little bit of an arty approach to the topic. And I think that's one the most important consequence.
You just finished hosting a major gathering of children's filmmakers and other people interested in kids' films from across the whole of Europe. Why did you bring all of these people together and how did it go?
It went very well. We had high temperatures, so we had ice cream all over the place.
Appropriate for a kids' film gathering.
It was really funny. On the first day, we had very sophisticated ice cream from an ice cream manufacturer here in the city. And then on the second day, when we ran out of ice cream, we just got all the things that kids love and the adults just loved them equally. It was quite fun to see. The idea was to bring together people from all over Europe, from the children's film community. This year it was the fourth edition. And this year it was really the first time where we put an emphasis on inviting people surrounding the children's film industry. So people from the wider film industry, but also from cultural industries and from politically important positions, because we are in a time where democracy and cultural diversity might be threatened or are threatened. And we really need to put our heads together to get an awareness of the young audience and how important it is to offer children local content in the cinemas and also content from their neighboring countries, from other European countries, because there is a market dominance by American films. And we still think it is important to offer a diverse range of films from European neighboring countries and all over Europe.
Why do you think it is so important that European kids get to see films that are made here?
I think it is really about seeing the own reality that you live in, the reality that you get portrayed in US blockbusters and Disney movies. Of course, topics like diversity or empowering young girls is a universal topic that resonates with children all around the world, but especially when it comes to live action, so not animated content, but live action, so real people portrayed on screen, it is important that children see, this is like my kind of elementary school, or this is my kind of playground, or this, I have visited this city, and sets of challenges that we have here as a child, or the way that school is organized, or how families are organized, or how communities look, is different in every European country and is definitely different to what's happening in the US.
We've established already that there is much less money floating around the European film industry than there is the US film industry. And if I understand correctly, this lack of money means that many European films are co-productions, right? They have cross-border teams behind them that have managed to pool sort of different pots of money from different countries. And this co-production also means that they often work together on writing the script. Has this resulted in films that feel more transnational and cross-border, or not necessarily?
In some ways, probably yes. And the reason for this is that when you're quote-unquote forced to work with others for a co-production, you're also quote-unquote forced to translate your ideas so that they are understandable for other audiences, which is a very good part of collaborating with someone. Now, not all co-productions mean collaborations on script, so co-productions could happen at very different stages. But just to give you an example of what a co-production potentially does, I was thinking about this, and it's not an ideal example. In 2009, there were two films that came out about war crimes in the context of the former Yugoslav wars. One was a co-production, a wonderful film called Ordinary People by a Serbian director called Vladimir Perisic, which is a co-production between Serbia, France, and I think Netherlands and Bulgaria, two other countries for sure. The other one came out in Croatia. It is called The Blacks or Crnci. And it's a film by two Croatian directors, Zvonimir Juric and Goran Devic. Both films are wonderful in how they treat crime committed during the war. But because one of them treats a local context and is funded entirely from one country, it mostly speaks to the audience in this one country. So it really focuses on a very specific story that is very familiar to local viewership, but isn't necessarily familiar to anyone outside. This was also a film that was very successful in the local context, or to an extent successful. It had a large socio-political impact, I think not much viewership, but it treated a very specific story. In the case of the co-production, what it did was that it translated this story at a much higher kind of level of abstraction. It is also a story about committing war crimes, but it takes away the topography of the place and it asks the question, why do we in general have a tendency to start committing a crime when we are engaged in a conflict? What happens? Almost like a kind of banality of evil story. Neither of these films is irrelevant to the domestic context, but one of them travels better. So co-productions can sometimes do this. They can encourage a script development in such a way that it speaks to a broader audience. And I think that sometimes is a very good thing.
Much as we love art house movies, is there an argument for changing the system so that European filmmakers are incentivized to make films that are a bit less artsy and have more of a mass appeal? And how else might we incentivize European filmmakers, if you do think it's a good idea, to make films with more of a mass appeal?
To be honest, I think the question is, do we actually want that? Do we want to copy US blockbusters? And my answer is no. You need to think about the audience from the first minute that you know you want to make a film out of this. And this is especially true when it comes to a young audience. You haven't been a child for quite some time when you are a filmmaker. And then there are often filmmakers that say, yeah, but I asked my child or my niece or my godchildren or whatever. That is not really empirical study of the audience that you want to reach. And there's an example from the Danish Film Institute, so the funding institution in Denmark. A couple of years ago, they started a program called Publikumsfokus, Within this funding scheme, you can apply for money specifically thinking from the first minute on, from script writing over production, testing the script, what kind of title to give to the movie, what kind of poster. And what we currently have as a situation in Europe is often that the film is done and then the distributor, the sales agent, stands there with a ready-made film and there is no marketing material. You don't know what to put on the poster. The title that was always the working title, they know it will not resonate with the audience. So they need to try to find a new title. So really this thinking more from the beginning already, what is going to happen at the end? I think this is something that we need to change in our system, not the system altogether. We don't need to mass produce other blockbusters with less budget.
The most viewed film in the European market last year was Asterix and Obelix. It looks to me like this was an attempt to create a kind of European blockbuster. And what I was really interested by was that when I looked into it, this was a film with around 60 million euro budget. So kind of attempt at really creating something that would be an equivalent of a European blockbuster. And it was the most seen film in Europe, about 6.5 million admissions. But it also failed. It didn't manage to recoup the money that was invested. So this kind of strategy may not really work on the proven empirical level either. We can see that we're not in Europe, not that good at copying this model, even if at first it looks like a success. But I absolutely agree with Anne. I think there's huge value to blockbusters as well. I think every cinema has its value. And I think we can learn a lot from superhero movies, just as we can learn a lot from European art cinema. But I am very fond of the idea that cinema doesn't necessarily have to be entertainment first and then everything else second. And I think mass appeal is a misleading or kind of misguiding phrasing because it indicates that right now European films do not have any appeal. I think we just maybe need to be sometimes on a policy level in terms of support for this, better at teasing out this mass appeal and finding the audience that a lot of the excellent films already have.
If I ask you to dream ahead to what you would like the European film industry to look like in 10 years' time, what would you tell me?
I would like to see a process of filmmaking that is a little bit more, I think, inclusive and a little bit more open to who gets to make a feature film. I really am a huge fan of European art cinema, but I very often notice that in the festivals, it is always the same names. And I would like to see a system of funding that is maybe a little kinder to first-time filmmakers and also a system of training that is maybe a little bit more open to a little more diversity because it seems to me to be a fairly closed art sphere.
I would love, and I know this might be an unrealistic goal, but 25% of all film funding budget allocated to children's films. I mean, 15% of the population in Europe is under 14. So at least 15% should be allocated to this age group. But to be fair, it should be 25, I think.
The kids deserve it. Thank you so much to Anna and Tamara for joining me. What you just heard was a snippet of a longer conversation about the European film industry that I really enjoyed. And you know what? I enjoyed it so much that we're going to post the whole conversation on our Patreon page for our supporters to enjoy. So if you're a film geek or you just fancy hearing a little bit more, you'll be able to find it at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast if you subscribe. It is time to chug into the inspiration station. It's recommendation time. Wojciech, what have you been enjoying this week?
Okay, Katie, so this is a trap.
Okay.
So last week, I messaged all of you on WhatsApp and nobody responded to me. And I wrote you that I think we should at some point acknowledge that a good portion of people living between Lisbon and Tbilisi are doing nothing these days except for watching Euro 2024, which is the European Football Championship. So I'm gonna do it now and I'm gonna talk about football.
Ugh, fine. Well, to be fair, Dominic is usually, weirdly, our sports correspondent and he's been away for 2 weeks, which is why we haven't talked about football and we have talked about slugs a lot.
Oh, that's a very mere excuse. You just completely neglected this very important thing going on in Europe.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's important. I'm glad that you're acknowledging the whole continent is football obsessed right now.
Yeah, I have to say I didn't plan to watch it because I stopped watching football almost entirely after the terrible World Cup in South Korea in 2002. At the time, referees did a lot to push the Korean team through to the semifinals, completely butchering Spain's and Italy's chances along the way, which I hated and was very disappointed as a 13-14 year old at the time. But then this year, my son, who's now in elementary school, he said that everyone was watching and he felt bad being unable to participate in the heated discussions among his friends. So we started watching a few games per week. And I have to say, it's not that bad of a show. There have been a lot of changes to the game since 2002. Like, they realized computers existed, and now there are referees looking at replays of controversial moments. So those kinds of Korean World Cup shenanigans are no longer possible, luckily. And you know, I mean, it's a bit of a thing that we say every time there is a football tournament in Europe, but it's a really nice display of European diversity and the ability to have fun together while competing against each other. I mean, it sounds really kitschy and banal, but I wish we could have more moments of being involved in something non-negative all at the same time on this continent. So yeah, I'm watching Euro and it's pretty fun.
Okay, you convinced me. I might watch one match. Who's your money on to win, or who is the most entertaining team to watch in your opinion?
I mean, your team, the French team, is just incredible. They could probably, you know, have two teams and still they would be, you know, somewhere around semi-final. So yeah, I guess I'm rooting for France.
Yay.
Especially since Mbappé became a politician. So definitely France.
Well, we need a win. So I'm glad Les Bleus are doing well.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Yeah, I've got a podcast recommendation for you this week.
Oh.
Sorry to mention the podcast Search Engine again, because I know I mentioned them in a slightly different context last week, but they've just released two episodes that I enjoyed very much. And it is two episodes about the legendary Berlin nightclub, Berghain.
Oh, really?
Have you been to Berghain?
No, I've not.
I haven't either. And to be honest, I have no interest in going. I'm not someone who has ever enjoyed going to nightclubs. When I was a student, I was always one of those people standing outside smoking so that I could actually talk to people. However, my hatred of nightclubs didn't stop me from enjoying these two podcasts. And they're essentially about a mystery. And that mystery is, why is it so hard to get into this nightclub? Because it is famously difficult. People will queue sometimes for up to 7 hours.
No
way. Only
to
be rejected. And it's not even like if you're a celebrity, you get in, or if you're an extremely conventionally attractive person, you'll get in. Sometimes they will let people in aged in their 50s who are really kind of dorkily dressed. But the bouncers are working under some kind of mysterious criteria that only they understand. Anyway, I won't tell you anything else other than that I think these podcasts really hit the sweet spot between being about something that's quite silly and frivolous, like why did this couple not get into a nightclub, and also some deeper, more interesting things to do with the history of Berlin and our relationship with music as humans and tax policy. Yes, tax policy. I thoroughly enjoyed this two-parter. If you're looking for them, they are the two latest podcasts in the Search Engine feed. They're called Why Didn't Chris and Dan Get Into Berghain? Parts 1 and 2.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, so my friends have been recommending Search Engine to me for quite some time now, and I started listening only 10 days ago, and I'm really enjoying it. I wasn't a big fan of Reply All, which was hosted by the host of Search Engine, but this one is like way better to me, and I love how they really go in depth trying to answer one question every week. I love the episode about drugs, for example. It was really eye-opening.
It's such a good show. Really recommend it.
Yeah. It's time for the happy ending.
Yay!
I've got something special for you. This week, Dominic sent me a voice memo from his holiday in Scotland.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's time for a happy ending. I'm sending you a voice note from my lovely holiday in Scotland. And the good news I want to share with you comes from the world of culture and heritage. So, the country I was born in, Great Britain, is famous for its museums and their exhibits, which, well, not all of them got there in a very respectable way, or to put it differently, they were looted from nations occupied during the colonial period. But the good news is that it feels like something is changing. Perhaps more and more pieces of art and other valuable artefacts will be returned to their rightful owners. Last week, the University of Oxford issued a statement that it will comply with the Indian High Commission's demand and hand back a 500-year-old sculpture of a Hindu saint, Tirumankai Alvar, to India. This is an incredibly beautiful, almost 60-centimetre tall bronze statue depicting a Tamil poet and saint from South India. It is believed to have been looted from an Indian temple during colonial times. This is yet another important milestone on this path. Last year in May, during the coronation of King Charles, Queen Consort Camilla wore her coronation crown without the controversial Koh-i-Noor diamond, a true treasure, one of the largest cut gems in the world, which was seized in Punjab in the 19th century by the British East India Company. This jewel is not going back to where it belongs yet, as there's a dispute over who it should be handed back to. But at least it has come to the monarch's awareness that walking around in jewellery that does not belong to them is not very chic. It makes me happy, and I'll be patiently awaiting more news on that front.
I mean, my first question is, what has being in Scotland for 2 weeks done to Dominic's accent?
Well, if you have to ask him.
What's going on there, Wojciech?
Yeah, so actually this is Dominic's voice that was cloned by an AI machine, which I think did a pretty good job, right?
I can't believe you made a robot Dominic just because he's not here.
I mean, he allows me to do this, but I really had a laugh while doing it. It was so funny. And it's sometimes it almost sounds like Dominic, but sometimes it's like pretty clear it's a robot.
It's not bad. He does sound like a version of Dominic that grew up closer to where I grew up. But other than that, it's really pretty good. And it's also a little bit disturbing. I don't know what to make of this. I mean, next week on the podcast, are you just going to replace both of us with robots? Because frankly, we don't need to be here anymore.
Yeah, I was just about to tell you, like, you're not necessary anymore. It's just, you know, voice clones from now on.
Oh, great. I've been fired.
Yeah, actually, yes.
That's it for this week. Wojciech, thanks for joining me with your robot. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. I loved it.
Dominic is finally back from his holiday next week. So he will be back in front of the microphone, human Dominic, revived and refreshed, which is good because he's going to be gridding me about the French election results. And I'm probably less likely to be revived and refreshed.
Thank you so much to Morgan Childs in Prague for producing this week's show along with Katie. And thank you to Kids Regio for supporting this episode.
You can find us in all the usual places on social media, X, sort of, Instagram, Mastodon and Blue Sky too. And if none of those floats your boat, come and look at our new website. It's got pigeons on it. And it's sexy. Europeanspodcast.com. We'll see you next week.
Hüvasti.
Bye.